From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Nancy Lindborg, President of the United States Institute of Peace, and we're coming to you from USIP headquarters in Washington. The United States Institute of Peace, or USIP, was established by Congress in 1984 as a nonpartisan, independent institution tasked with promoting conflict resolution and prevention worldwide. It provides research, analysis, and training to individuals in diplomacy, mediation, and other peace-building measures. In recent days, USIP released a report that outlines a new strategy to prevent extremism in fragile states. The findings are all the more relevant given the recent suicide bombings by Islamic State-affiliated extremists on Easter Sunday in Sri Lanka. Despite our success protecting the U.S. homeland, extremism is spreading. Since the September 11, 2001 attacks on U.S. soil, the number of terrorist attacks worldwide per year has increased fivefold. As long as this continues, America will remain vulnerable to terrorism. The USIP report argues that we need a new strategy to prevent extremism in fragile states. If we can mitigate the underlying conditions that allow extremism to emerge and spread in these states, the United States and our allies will be closer to breaking out of the costly cycle of perpetual crisis response. We must move from defeating terrorists to preventing extremism. Well, prior to joining USIP, Nancy Lindborg served as the Assistant Administrator for the Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance at USAID. From 2010 through early 2015, Ms. Lindborg led USAID teams focused on building resilience and democracy, managing and mitigating conflict, and providing urgent humanitarian assistance. Prior to that, Ms. Lindborg was president of Mercy Corps, where she spent 14 years helping the humanitarian aid organization gain global respect for innovative programs in some of the most challenging environments. Well, on this edition of the program, we'll talk with Ms. Lindborg about the mission of USIP, the state of violent extremism around the world today, and many other topics. Ms. Lindborg, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. Nice to be here with you.
And thanks again for hosting us here at USIP. Let's begin by talking about the primary mission of USIP and in which countries you work.
As you said, USIP was founded by Congress about 35 years ago, and it was actually catalyzed by members of Congress who were themselves veterans of World War II and the Korean War. And they came back from their battlefield experiences really seared with what they saw and taken with the idea that the United States needed additional capacity to wage peace as effectively as we wage war. And so that was the beginning of U.S. Institute of Peace, which was signed into law in 1984. And we have a singular mission of preventing and resolving conflict. And we look out from our global headquarters here on Washington's National Mall at the Abraham Lincoln Memorial. And that reminds us every day that when you cannot manage conflict without it becoming violent, you have the kind of upheaval that we saw here with our own civil war. And so the question is, how do you manage conflict so it can become transformative instead of tearing apart families, societies, and countries? It's a mission that we pursue by working with partners around the world and linking research with education, with support for partners who are right on the front lines trying to manage that conflict.
And what is your background and what led you to this type of work?
So as you noted, I've spent nearly the last 30 years working in places that have been torn apart by conflict, filled with bombs and riddled with bullets, or sometimes torn apart by natural disasters. When I started my career, global humanitarian assistance went 80% to victims of natural disaster. Today, 80% of that assistance goes to victims of violent conflict. And so as the years went by, it became more and more clear how important it was to get ahead of these conflicts, to look more at how to help people have the tools and the means to build peace, to manage conflict, to avoid the kind of downstream effects that the founders of USIP were motivated by. And, you know, you can only do Band-Aids so long before you start wanting to think about what's the actual cure. And that's how I think about what we're doing here at U.S. Institute of Peace, is really trying to get ahead of the violence breaking out, how to interrupt those cycles of violence and help those communities and countries and regions become more peaceful.
Well, that leads me to ask you about the findings from the report on the Task Force on Extremism in Fragile States. It seems to me that that's exactly what your objective is in that report, to get underneath the problem and prevent problems before they reach violence. The report says that there's been a fivefold increase in terrorist attacks despite lessons learned from the 2001 9/11 attacks. If we were supposed to have learned some important lessons, why are we seeing so much more extremism and the violence that flows from it?
One of the things that we do here at our global headquarters is provide a really powerful platform for bringing people together from across different views, political areas of expertise, to come together to think about some of the toughest foreign policy challenges that we face. And Congress charges us with bringing these groups together when we have these kinds of issues, which is what they did last year. They asked USIP to convene a bipartisan group of distinguished, eminent officials to look at this issue. And it's exactly as you said. It's looking at how do you prevent the conditions that are associated with fragile states that give rise to extremism and enable extremism to take hold and to spread and find recruits. And those conditions are things like marginalized groups, feelings of exclusion, lack of opportunity. One of the greatest findings is that repressive security forces are a huge factor in pushing people towards choosing violent extremism. We are far too focused on treating the symptoms, on doing the kind of important and necessary but not sufficient work of addressing violent extremism after it happens. We're not saying not do that, but we are not sufficiently looking at the conditions that enable that to give rise. As you noted, since 9/11, the U.S. homeland has been kept safe, but extremism has spread around the world. The U.S. has spent $6 trillion fighting extremism. So the task force was co-chaired actually by the same co-chairs that did the 9/11 commission 17 years ago, Congressman Hamilton and Governor Kaine. And they felt a real calling to do this because one of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission was to develop a preventive strategy, which was never picked up. So this, finally, is that preventive strategy. And it charts a course with three main recommendations. The first is to have a government-wide shared understanding of these conditions that give rise to extremism. Secondly, is to enable our various government capabilities to have more flexibility to work together and to sustain their efforts for the long game, which we know is necessary. These are often generational changes. And third, knowing that the U.S. can't do it alone, work with our international partners, but work also in partnership with the fragile state. That's how change happens most effectively, with that long-term coordinated action that is driven through local action.
How would you define fragile state? What are some examples?
Fragile is defined by fundamentally a broken social contract between a state and its citizens, where people no longer trust their government to address grievances, to provide basic services, where there is a lack of sense of security, and fragile states are usually characterized by very fragmented societies. And it's a spectrum. You know, there are a lot of ways to measure fragility through social, economic, security factors, political factors, and there are a number of indices that measure where one is on the spectrum of fragility, and you can be a fragile community within a less fragile state. So you can have areas of fragility. Nigeria is a good example where in the Northeast, they've been overrun and plagued by the extremist group Boko Haram. That doesn't characterize the totality of the country, but that part of the state is extremely fragile. And it has all the characteristics that we associate with that kind of fragility. Historically marginalized area, people who didn't have a lot of opportunities to be included in the political system or economic opportunities, a sense of grievance and injustice.
There are other places probably in Africa as well. I suppose the Sahel would be the larger Sahel region.
Well, interestingly, Congress, when they asked USIP to convene this task force, the explicit request was to develop a comprehensive plan to address the conditions in fragile states that give rise to extremism in the Sahel, the Horn of Africa, and the Middle East, because those are the areas that have the greatest number of fragile states. And fragility is really a common denominator for the likelihood that there will be extremist activities. It's also where there are more likelihood to have civil wars, the primary sources of refugees and out-migration. So if we think about fragility as the condition that needs to be addressed, it really enables us to look at a host of some of the most troubling issues that create human suffering and insecurity.
What do you see are the biggest impediments in actually implementing this new strategy? And how has the U.S. government received the report? Is there a willingness, a political will to try to implement these very recommendations?
Well, interestingly, there are now two bills, one in the House, one in the Senate, that are both called Reducing Global Fragility, that mirror some of the recommendations that are contained in this report. So I think what we're seeing is a convergence of people thinking more deeply about how to get at the root of these most troubling issues. You know, we're at a time of historic number of people displaced by violence. You know, we've had historic number of famines. We've had this significant uptick in violent extremism. And so it really does require all of us to think differently about this. So we have the bills going through the House and the Senate. There's been a lot of interest from the administration. We're also seeing in places like the World Bank and the UN and some of the other international donors a move towards thinking differently about how to address these conditions of fragility. And fundamentally, it goes to better governance. And you asked, what are the impediments? The impediments are that it's hard, and it can't be because an outside actor wants it. It has to be driven by local will, local political actors, local civil society, religious, you know, women, youth. It has to be driven locally is one of the core lessons that we discuss in the report that I think is a lesson that has been broadly learned over the past decade and a half or longer.
But if some of your interlocutors are governments which are perpetuating these kinds of heavy-handed tactics or are not transparent, are not really democratic, that must be a major challenge.
It's the major conundrum, and you know, this is hard, which is why it hasn't been done. But we're seeing several factors. One is that we're not always coordinated across our development, our diplomatic, and our security efforts. And this is why framing this in the quest to prevent extremism is so important, because oftentimes there's a big push for support to security sector, military, border guards, militias, to enable them to be more effective in capturing violent extremists or terrorists. And what we've learned through a lot of research is that if those tactics are too heavy-handed, you could inadvertently, in fact, increase the number of recruits to those extremist groups. So that's why one of the recommendations is really gathering a more shared understanding based on the best research and learnings of how to be more coordinated in preventing extremism. We can't only do this through kinetic action. We can't only do it through heavy-handed security forces. It's got to also be looking at how do we deploy our diplomatic efforts, how do we employ development, and how do we do it with willing partners. There is an acknowledgement in the report that you can't do this everywhere. We have to be selective. And so the third recommendation about working with international partners and fragile states partners envisions a fund that actually uses a compact model where there would be an agreement with the local partner of here's what they want to do, here's what we'll support them in doing as long as it moves towards these shared goals.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest is Nancy Lindborg. She's president of the United States Institute of Peace, and that's a U.S.-funded institution dedicated to conflict resolution and prevention worldwide. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Peace USA podcast is available on our website via iTunes at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal listener, Inodu Emmanuel Onyedi from Gombe, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Nancy Lindborg, president of USIP. Nancy.
And Carol, I was in Gombe last year.
Really?
So let me add to the shout out.
How about that? Very good. Well, I wanted to actually turn briefly to Iraq because you were there recently to talk about the situation on the ground. The so-called Islamic State was routed, but remnants remain and the ideology persists. What did you observe and how would you assess the political situation given the predominantly Shia Muslim leadership and security forces, and to what extent they're still seen suspiciously by, you know, the Sunni groups who have been previously lured by Daesh or IS? How is that going?
Well, I was there a few weeks ago, and I hadn't been there for a year. And in that year, there was a lot of positive progress. You know, they had their fourth peaceful election since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. There were mixed ethnic slates running in those elections where they had Shia, Sunni, and minority groups running together, Kurds running together. Of course, they defeated the territorial caliphate. So all good. The challenge, however, is making sure that they don't just go back into a spin cycle where they don't deal with the conditions that gave rise to ISIS in the first place. There are still areas where services are not being equitably delivered. I think really importantly, there's still 1.8 million people who have not been able to go home. And then there's an additional, something like, the numbers are unclear, but like 5,000 families who are suspected ISIS family members who are being held in detention camps. All of this is a ferment that can definitely lead to the kind of grievance, the kind of sense of injustice that can lead to another round of extremism. I will say that USIP has worked in Iraq for a decade and a half, and we've worked extensively with a network of Iraqi facilitators, giving them training and support, and they have been conducting a series of local dialogues that bring people together, Sunni, Shia, different ethnic groups, and they are negotiating local accords that come to agreement for the basis upon which people are able to return home. And it's that kind of repair of the local social fabric that is as important as repair of the infrastructure. And that needs to continue, that needs to happen across the country so that they can interrupt what is otherwise going to be another cycle of violence.
Well, speaking of terrorism, does USIP have a position regarding the rise in militant white nationalism, which we're seeing in some of the most sophisticated, long-standing democracies around the world, hardly fragile states? We saw the terrible tragedy in New Zealand with the Australian extremist Brenton Harrison Tarrant allegedly killing 50 people at two mosques in Christchurch. We're seeing heinous acts of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism here in the United States. So statistics reveal that hate crimes and violence emanating from white nationalism and white supremacist violence are almost surpassing now Islamist extremism acts of violence.
You know, no group holds the sole franchise on extremism. The extremism comes in all flavors and all colors, and we see this whether it's Buddhist in Burma, Myanmar, or white nationalists in New Zealand or the United States. So what we look at here at USIP are, what are some of the causes of violent extremism? What causes individuals to be attracted to the kind of ideology that leads them to violence? And those are the questions that we ask and research. And, you know, some interesting findings about some of the impact on the actual neural infrastructure of your brain that might cause someone to choose violence instead of not. Of course, all of this is greatly complicated by the rise of the internet and the ways that technology connects people globally. And, you know, once you've got a hardcore recruit, then you're in the realm of counterterrorism. And that's a different set of tools and a different approach than what we're talking about with this prevention approach, which is really looking at the conditions that enable that ideology to take hold and really go viral in a community.
I'd like to also now turn to the role of women in conflict resolution. Women often bear the brunt of violence, sexual violence, when conflict breaks out, but they're seldom included at the negotiating table when it's time to mediate or end a conflict. Back in 2000, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 1325 on Women, Peace, and Security, which recognized the pivotal role women can and should play in the process of peace building and conflict prevention. Nancy, do you see anywhere in the world where women are, in fact, participating in peace talks, conflict mediation, and conflict prevention? Are we seeing more women at the table?
Well, we're seeing more, but we're not seeing enough. And we're at the 20-year anniversary of the Women, Peace, and Security Act that you referred to, 1325, and it's weak progress at best for a 20-year effort. But I think there is progress, and we need to hold on to that and keep moving forward, because there's a lot of evidence, there's a lot of data that tell us that when women are at the peace table in a significant way, not just in a token way, that there is a greater likelihood of that peace accord lasting longer. And that's actually true not just for women, but just a more inclusive process. And we saw that with the Columbia Peace Accords, that when you had the victims, the internally displaced, the women, when they were all at the peace table, it is a stronger, more enduring peace accord. We're also seeing that the U.S. was the first country, and I think it might only still be the only country, that passed legislation requiring the U.S. government to have an implementation plan for the Women, Peace, and Security Act that was driven by Senator Shaheen, one of our wonderful women senators, but broadly supported. Whenever I travel, I meet with amazing women, many of whom are deeply dedicated to passing and pushing women, peace, and security in their own countries. In Iraq, I met with an incredible group of women who have put a lot of legislation in place that protects women, that enables women to participate more broadly. Some of that is now at risk, given forces in their country. So it underscores that you can never say the job is done. It's what we say here at USIP is peace is a process, and it's not an end state. And so once we make these gains, you can assure that they'll be held.
How about Afghanistan? Do you see women participating in resolving that longstanding war?
Well, as you know, there's a peace process underway right now. One of the big questions is both how to ensure greater participation by women. There are women who have gone to Doha to be a part of that conversation. There was just a Loya Jirga held in Afghanistan where there were a number of women participating. I think there's a question about whether there's still the cultural openness to enable real and substantive participation, but certainly there are amazing women in Afghanistan who are pushing that fight. There's a second question about, is there a peace accord possible where the Taliban would respect the Constitution, which has enshrined the rights for women in Afghanistan? So this is what's hanging in the breach right now. And it's against a backdrop of extraordinary gains, important gains by Afghan women over the past decade and a half.
Do you see any examples in Africa of women participating in a more aggressive or more inclusive way?
Well, I think the very best example that should give all of us heart is the example of Tunisia. And when you go to Tunisia, which of course is one of the only countries that came through the so-called Arab Spring and stayed on a path to peace and prosperity, you talk to whether it's the president or people on the street, they will all say the reason that they were able to maintain that peaceful pathway is that back in the 50s, they invested in girls' education. And so they have a cadre of educated professional women who have been equally at the table throughout this whole process. So it underscores that these are generational processes, but that that is part of the important answer, is being able to have an engaged, inclusive society where all, you know, women, men, and youth, by the way, are an important factor in all this as well, have a voice and are at the table.
Exactly. Well, that leads me to ask you about a youth program that USIP sponsors, because you talked about peace being a generational process. You sponsor youth leaders from conflict-ridden countries to meet the Dalai Lama. This has been going on for several years. Talk about the objective of that and how successful it's been, and if women are among many of these youth leaders as well.
You know, there are 1.8 billion youth globally right now. This is an all-time high. And many of them, of course, live in fragile and conflict-affected countries, which have the youngest, fastest-growing youth populations. USIP has a global network called Generation Change. And each year, we bring 20 of those youth leaders to a week-long retreat in Dharamsala, India, the centerpiece of which is a two-day dialogue with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And it's really about enabling them, all of whom come from conflict countries, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, Tunisia, Sudan, South Sudan, Yemen, Somalia, you know, of that nature, Syria. And they have all, at important moments of their life, chosen to choose a pathway of peace and to be leaders in their communities for a more peaceful future instead of succumbing to hate and violence. One of the reasons we take them to meet the Dalai Lama, who is himself a refugee, is that to pursue that kind of work in places that are filled with conflict takes an inner resilience, takes an inner strength to maintain your compass so that you can stay on this pathway and stay true to your commitment. And so it's a very powerful dialogue, and actually the Dalai Lama gets as much from these extraordinary youth leaders as they get from him. And then, of course, they have a network that sustains them with a lot of very practical training that they're provided with: leadership skills, problem-solving skills, negotiation, mediation skills. But this is really a highlight of my year. We're preparing to do our fourth year now this fall. And some of the youth leaders that I've met are so incredibly inspiring, whether it's helping to return women and girls in Borno State in Nigeria to a young man who was on his way to college in Aleppo when the war broke out in Syria. He found himself a day laborer in Lebanon, but instead of despairing, he started a school to educate young Syrian refugees. And then he was able to get himself a scholarship, and he's now graduating from American University of Beirut. But, you know, we live in a story, in a world that's awash with negative stories. And it's heartening and I think important to also fasten on to the many, many stories of courageous people who are dedicated to building peace in the world.
Nancy Lindborg is the president of the United States Institute of Peace. Nancy, thank you so much for a terrific conversation and for the work you do here at USIP.
Thanks, Carol. Nice to be with you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer and producer was Ted Schneider. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.